From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so pleased that you took the time to download us and you're listening today. We are bringing you another really fascinating individual from the world of sports medicine and human performance, and this goes along with our initiative where we're looking at athletes in the arts, and so we have Ms. Jenny Morton on with us today from the United Kingdom. Welcome to the podcast today, Jen.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Let me tell the audience a little bit about you while we've got you on. Jen has got a huge resume as a performer and as a teacher and as a clinical practitioner. She worked as a ballet dancer and then in musical theater on tour and in the West End of London for many years. And for those of you on the podcast that aren't familiar with the West End, that's a kind of the older, more established equivalent of our Broadway here in the United States. She trained as a sports massage therapist at St. Mary's University. She is a qualified osteopath, and she has over 20 years of experience in teaching all styles of music. She has been working with the British Association for Performing Arts Medicine in London. She does training, both vocal and dance training, all over the world. She has trained many performers that are on our Broadway, and we were just chatting about, she was recently in Morocco as well, which she will tell us about in a few minutes. She continues to sing as a professional singer with the group Manhattan Music at various venues, both nationally and internationally, and I was privileged to have Jenny as part of a presentation I did at a recent meeting, and let me tell you, folks, she knocked the socks off everybody, and there was no way that the band members could keep up with her. So we're so glad to have you on the podcast today, Jenny.
Great to be here.
So let's just get started off. Many people may not think about injuries in dancers and vocalists and musicians. Do those kind of things happen?
Absolutely. And it is something that I come across all the time when I talk to people about what I do, and they say, "Oh, performers get injured."
Yeah.
I think it's a cultural thing. It's if you go to a sports event and somebody gets injured at a football match, tennis match, whatever, the whole thing will stop. The trainer will come on. They're all treated in full view of everyone. They're stretchered off if necessary. Someone else is brought on. If you go to the ballet, you go to a concert, a rock concert, an orchestral concert, and somebody gets injured, they're not going to stop the whole thing and bring the physical trainer on and treat them in full view of everyone. It's hidden. Nobody wants to know about it. They want, people come to the performing arts for escapism. They don't want to know these people are human and that they break. So I think culturally there's this sort of idea that these people are superhuman and don't get injured. And that also then is reflected into the performers themselves, that there's an awful lot of negating of their own injuries, pretending it's not happening because they don't want to face the fact that this might stop them from doing their performance and earning their living. So I think it comes from both sides, really.
So that really is also, as you just said, part of that performer's credo of the show must go on.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let's talk about vocalists for just a moment.
Okay.
People may not think that vocalists get injured, but their injuries may not be the big orthopedic type that we're used to thinking about, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the singers that I treat in the clinic in London, they're normally presenting with some sort of issue with the voice in terms of perhaps they're missing part of their natural range. Mm. They've lost an upper register. There's some sort of huskiness or crack coming through the voice. They've got issues with breathing patterns, something like that. What we have to understand about the voice is that it is an organic instrument. Mm. So it's going to be very reflective of not only their state of physical health, but also their state of emotional health as well. Any sort of anxiety, any issues in their personal life may well be brought into the vocalizing. So we really have to look at this instrument as in the context of all of that.
A very holistic approach to it.
Totally.
Yeah.
And the other thing to understand about the vocal anatomy is its location in the body. Mm. Obviously, the vocal apparatus is sitting in the neck area, in the front of the neck area. We have the larynx, which is the voice box that glides up and down in the throat as we sing, speak, vocalize in any way. And we also have the hyoid bone above that, which is a very unique bone in the body. It's a little horseshoe-shaped bone. Sits just above the voice box, but it is the only bone in the body that doesn't articulate with any other bone. Most bones of the skeleton meet another bone at a joint. This one doesn't. It's literally suspended in space by a sling of muscle attachments. Hmm. And these muscles originate from various structures around, from the skull to the jaw, down to the voice box, the larynx itself, down to the sternum. There's even a muscle that goes from the hyoid bone to the inside surface of your shoulder blade. So the alignment of all those skeletal structures around it are going to have a direct effect on the ability of the voice to be optimal and to be able to glide freely in this area. So the neck obviously is a very mobile area in the body. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it has the ability to sort of have this sort of plastic tendency to reflect any anomalies in the postural structures below it. So when I'm treating singers, vocalists, I'm not just looking at the voice structures, the vocal apparatus. I'm going to start at the feet and work all the way up, because how the feet contact the ground, how the structures above them are built, creates the foundation and the level surface, or the not level surface in some people's cases, mm-hmm. for the vocal apparatus to work optimally. Mm-hmm. So the human body appears to be symmetrical. It's not. And some people are always quite surprised when I'm examining them and I say, oh, well, you've got one leg that's slightly longer than the other. This is quite a common thing. Some people have that to more or less a degree. If the legs are not equal in length, when you're standing up, and most vocalists are working in a standing position, mm-hmm. the floor obviously levels the feet up. Mm-hmm. So if you've got one leg that's a bit longer, it's going to push the pelvis up slightly on one side.
Right.
Therefore, the pelvis is now not level. The spine originates in the pelvis. The sacral bone, which is the triangular-shaped bone at the base of the spine, is held between the two ilia, the bones of the pelvis. So if that's not level, it's going to start the spine off on a tilted journey. Mm-hmm. We are designed, survival mechanism really, that we need to have our head oriented over the center of our bodies. Number one, if the spine's starting off at a tilted angle, the head that can weigh, you know, an average of about 12 pounds, it's a very heavy bit of kit, mm-hmm. is going to, if it's not sort of coming off a straight spine, we're going to fall over.
Sure.
So the body needs to bring that head back over the center of gravity. Also, our eyes need to be, as a sort of, again, a primitive survival mechanism, our eyes need to be level. That enables us to judge distances. Mm. This is a survival mechanism. If we're being approached by a predator, we need to judge how far that predator is away to devise our exit strategy. So the body will always right itself. Mm-hmm. So if we've got this pelvis that's at a slightly tilted angle, we've got a spine that's heading off to one side, the muscles around that are going to start to contract to draw the spine back towards the midline. Often this is a little too exaggerated, so a little bit further above that, something else will pull us back the other way, and we start to get this zigzag pattern through the spine, which ultimately lands up with the neck, bringing the eyes back to a level position. Mm. So this is what's known as a scoliosis in the spine. Mm-hmm. Some people are born with this. It's something that is structurally inherent within their anatomy. Other people will develop this out of habitual postures, the way they habitually sit, or if they sit with their legs crossed and their pelvis isn't level, the muscles will start to take on these shapes and create what we call a functional scoliosis. So all of these effects are going to affect the ability of that vocal mechanism that's sitting freely in the in the neck area to glide up and down optimally and produce sound without tension.
Well, but what you're talking about is, in most cases, you're talking about someone standing level. I mean, I've seen musical theater where you have vocalists that are suspended. I mean, there's one, like the Spider-Man right now, is one that was on Broadway, where a lot of their vocalists were suspended. I guess the most common thing is all the dancing that often goes on in musical theater. And so the person isn't standing still when they're trying to dance. And I know that's one of your specialties, is working with folks who sing and dance. So how do you compensate for that? How do you keep the voice steady? How do you train people to do that if they're going to be moving and they're going to lose that solid foundation?
Yeah, so this is a very tricky area. And what it comes down to is the singer needs to know where home base is. They need to have a good sort of understanding of where neutral is in their body and for their voice, so that they, wherever they are in the movement, they're moving in and out of that neutral, but they've always got the neutral to come back to and try and find that as often as they can throughout the movement. The issue with dancing and singing simultaneously is actually more of an issue of breathing patterns. Mm-hmm. So dance training, anybody that dances to any kind of standard will have gone through very rigorous dance training from very young in age. Mm-hmm. The dance training trains you, particularly in your classical training, to pull the abdominal muscles in and up, brace in and up. Mm-hmm. And this is absolutely inherent in every dancer that you see. If you then come into trying to vocalize on top of that, you're actually creating an issue with the breathing patterns. Mm-hmm. So in order to breathe optimally, I mean, basically singing is exhalation. Sure. You know, singing happens on an out-breath.
Sure.
To have a nice, long, sustained phrase, we need a good tank of air to be able to sustain that exhalation. So we need to draw in a full tank of air. The way the body does this, the diaphragm, which is the large muscle that sort of bisects the body from front to back at the base of the rib cage, it's a domed structure at rest. When you take an in-breath, the diaphragm contracts and flattens, and to do that, it actually has to push the abdominal contents, all our abdominal organs, down and outwards. So we need an expansion of the abdomen in order to get a full lung full of breath. If the dancer is bracing their abdominal muscles inwards and upwards, they're actually restricting that expansion. Therefore, the diaphragm is unable to make a full descent. Therefore, then unable to take in as full a breath. So they're doing what we call upper chest or shallow breathing. Mm-hmm. So just breathing with the sort of upper mechanisms. So they're going to have less breath in the system to sustain phrases. But also, when you're trying to get volume, and particularly in musical theatre where a lot of the sound is this very strong belt sound, if you don't have enough what we call subglottal air pressure, enough pressure below the glottis, which is the little sphincter at the top of the vocal mechanism, you won't be able to create that sound naturally. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the singer will start to try and create that by overworking the muscles, particularly the muscles that attach to the upper surface of the hyoid, what we call the suprahyoid muscles. And they're going to start, like any muscle, if you overwork it or use it inappropriately, it's going to get strained and in trouble. Mm-hmm. And this is where we can start to see issues with vocal strain. So trying to train the dancers to be able to release the abdominal muscles to take an efficient in-breath is one of the primary areas that I focus on when working with these individuals, because it's just completely at odds with what they think performance is. And I went through this myself, moving from being a ballet dancer into musical theatre. And for me, when performance, you go on stage, the first thing that happens is the abs go in and up. It's just like a learnt sort of behaviour. So you have to kind of deconstruct that and allow them to trust that they will have the support necessary to create all the dance moves that they need to do without bracing those muscles in and up. At some points that may be necessary, at other points it isn't necessary. So we need to be able to tread a path between when it's appropriate to brace the muscles and when you need to release them to get the breath in.
Do they have you? Do shows have you come in and consult, particularly in musical theater, if they may be having problems with the vocalist, or do the producers of these shows basically hire these people and assume they're going to be able to do it, and if they can't, then they move on to somebody else?
Unfortunately, that tends to be the way at the moment it happens, is that it's, you know, if you can get by and do it, great. If you break, well, there's another 100 dancers and singers that we can employ to come in and do it. So I tend to work more on an individual basis rather than through production. But it would be my dream that production would consult specialists in this area. But actually, I think what it really comes down to is the training. That in musical theatre training, it is very rare for this, what we call integrative training, to occur. In training establishments, you tend to do all your dance training in one room with a dance trainer. Mm-hmm. You do all your vocal training in another room with the vocal coach, and the two never really talk to each other. And then when you come into production, the choreographer does all the choreography in one room, the musical director teaches you the vocal repertoire in another room, and they tell you, right, you need to breathe at this point in this phrase and this point in that phrase. Mm-hmm. But it might be that you're upside down in a lift at that point, or you're at the top of a jump, and the breathing patterns to get you there physically are running counter to what is required to get that vocal moment. So in my dream world, we have choreographers and musical directors who talk to each other and say, okay, well, I want this to be a big vocal moment in the show, so perhaps we'll put a dance move in there that will support that, rather than what happens at the moment, where the dancer is left to try and figure this out for themselves.
So does that not happen? That kind of communication does not happen between the choreographers and the vocal folks?
Not in my experience, and not in the experience of the individual performers that I work with. Mm. So I've just been recently in New York working with some Broadway performers there, and I was chatting to them about this and saying, are you taught this? And they said, no, we were never taught it in college, and in the theatre now we're just left to figure it out for ourselves. So the performer is left to try and work through that problem and find a way around it themselves. And a lot of them will manage to do that. But, you know, I would like to see this become part of musical theatre training, that they are taught how to integrate these two things safely. Because I obviously see the end point of this when people come in trouble, either with their voice or with their lower back or their hips. A lot of the singers that are required to dance don't have as good a dance training but have a better singing training. Mm. They're using great breathing patterns for their singing, but it's not giving them the required lumbar stabilization for the dance moves that they're doing. So they're coming in with lower back problems. So it works both ways. So for health and safety of these performers, I would like to see a lot more integration, and that's my mission at the moment. So I'm slowly getting there.
So how do you accomplish that mission? Is this an early age education thing, or is this getting the music, the dance and the vocal teachers together? So how are you going about doing this, fulfilling this mission?
Well, I've just launched a new certification course in New York, along with the voice specialist Joan Melton, who has written many books on the subject of voicing for musical theatre and for acting. Mm. So we call these musical theatre performers our triple threat performers, because they're required to dance, sing, and act. Mm. And these are all taught at the moment as separate entities rather than integrated disciplines. So we have developed a certificate course for voice teachers to learn integrative methods. So we've just done our first course a month ago in New York, and we had some master voice teachers from all over the world, some of whom work with classical singers, some work with musical theatre performers, some work with classical actors. But they will recognise that they need to understand the other disciplines better, so that if they have a ballet dancer coming into them for voice training, they know where this dancer is coming from and what patterns they're using. So we have created this course where we're teaching them anatomy from the foot to the head, not just of the vocal apparatus, which tends to be their training at the moment. And also I'm teaching them all the different dance disciplines, letting them understand what these dancers are having to do and how they've been trained, and how we can, using the anatomy, safely integrate all these disciplines and have them, you know, have an optimal performance in the safest way possible.
Wow. Sounds great. So all that training is fascinating. And so let's move a little bit off the training a little bit and talk about how you got into this. You obviously were a performer from a very early age. How did you decide that you wanted to get into healthcare performers?
I think that started I was at age 17. I was at dance college. I was sort of a year away from going into the profession, and I ended up with a horrible injury, shin splints, and to the point where I could barely walk, let alone dance. And just completely by fate, on our college notice board, a poster went up about an osteopath who was an ex-dancer and in her final year of osteopathic training and was doing a thesis on shin splints in dancers and wanted volunteers to come and be part of her case study.
Right place, so, right time, huh?
Right place, right time. Serendipity. So I leapt at the chance and went and worked with her. And at that point, I'd been in full-time dance training for 10 years. I'd started full-time training at 7. I'd been training since I was 2 years old. And the things that she picked up on in her examination of me and of my dance technique, no teacher in all those 10 years had picked up on. This was using the anatomy in a very finite way to look at the dance technique. And basically, the way I was approaching dance technique was jamming my anatomy up and causing this problem. So she, within the space of 3 months, worked very intensively with me, got rid of the problem, but also solved an awful lot of other issues that I was having around achieving the sort of the extreme postures required for classical ballet. So this kind of, you know, lit a little light bulb in my head and thought, this is very interesting. So that was in the back of my mind, and then I went through my dance career, had my share of injuries, had surgery on one foot, and you start to learn a lot about your body. And then every show I did, I tended to end up being the unofficial company masseur. I just had a bit of a knack for it. People used to gravitate towards me and say, I'll give you a bottle of wine if you do my neck for me. And then the more I did that, people would say, yeah, you should train in this. You know, maybe you should do it. So initially I trained in sports massage whilst I was still working in theatre. So I combined the two for a while, and then I just got more and more of a taste for it. And I recognized that there was a missing gap in the market for people who really understood the technique behind dancing, singing, playing a musical instrument, in terms of being a therapist. People that I used to go to, if they had no understanding of what I did for a living, they could only really treat the symptoms and couldn't get down to the cause. So I decided that I wanted to go into training as an osteopath and to bridge that gap in the market and make sure that every musician that comes in to me for treatment, they bring their instrument with them. We look at how they're playing, because the root of their injury normally lies somewhere within their technique and posture. The same with dancers, we pick apart their technique, and the same with vocalists. So we get to cause, and we don't just fix the symptoms, and 6 months later they're back with the same problem.
Cool. That's great. And we haven't even talked about musicians today, but that's certainly part of the whole performing arts. As you think about your career and why you do what you do, do you have any particular success stories that really jump out at you?
Yeah, I mean, my work is an absolute, you know, pleasure to sort of help people who come in. But clearly, performers, when they're injured or there's something affecting their ability to perform their craft and earn their living, you know, it's a very anxiety-producing situation for them. Even, you know, a paper cut to an office worker won't make them particularly anxious, but on their finger, but a paper cut to a violinist is going to be extremely anxiety-provoking. So you're dealing with a different psychology. So when you help somebody get through this, and a lot of the time my job is about normalizing it for them as well. You know, this might be the first injury they've had, or I had a singer who was a singer with a top rock band in the UK and had got to the point where he could barely sing anymore because he'd just jammed himself up with the muscles around the area and with the technique that he was using. And he was, you know, very, very anxious when he came in and very upset. And we worked over a course of a few weeks and unraveled the things that were going on. The voice started to come back, and for me a lot of it was just normalizing this for him, saying, I see this all the time, it's nothing to worry about, we can do something about it. As talking about the voice as being an organic instrument reflective of emotional states, the anxiety itself was causing part of the vocal issue. So just the reassurance and the process of working through and him understanding the organic instrument that he has. Most musical instrument players can take their instrument apart and put it back together again, but most singers have no concept of what this apparatus is that they're using. Mm-hmm. So giving him the tools to deal with that, and allowing the voice to just to come back, and giving him the tools to manage it going forwards was, you know, wonderful situation for both of us. You know, for him, obviously, it was a huge relief, and for me, just an absolute pleasure to be able to help somebody on that journey, and that's why I absolutely love what I do.
So every time you hear him sing, you go, hey, I helped that, right?
Yeah, yeah, and he tells people, too. So, you know, obviously, we have issues of confidentiality when we're treating patients, so a lot of the people that I treat, we don't, you know, they don't necessarily talk about it. There's a big issue with performers that they don't want other people to know they're injured or having problems because that could affect their higher ability. You know, if people know they're injured, they, oh, well, I won't ask them to do this job. You know, it's a word-of-mouth business. Yeah. But he's been very great at talking loudly and freely about his journey with me and encouraging other singers to you know, embrace this and to understand their voice better and to learn more about it and get some regular maintenance treatment. We get our car serviced every year, but, you know, the body we tend to sort of leave to get on with it, and problems are often accumulative. So if people can just adopt healthy practice routines, then they can keep themselves healthy. I'd much rather help keep someone healthy than try and fix them once things have gone wrong.
Right. Jen, this has been a fascinating conversation. Certainly, I know for our audience, this is a different look at performance medicine than probably most of them have heard or seen. Unfortunately, we're running short on time, and as we do with all of our guests, we wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us your take-home message. If everybody that's listening to this is going to remember one thing, what thing should they remember?
I think, speaking to any performers that are listening, the thing to remember that is, your body is an amazing structure. It is capable of the most amazing things, to produce the sounds that we can produce, the movements that we can produce. But it needs looking after, and it needs understanding. And if you can take some time to work with a practitioner, really understand the tools that you've got available, you can ensure the health of that structure going forwards. You can keep yourself healthy. You can probably even optimize things and improve your performance. And to anybody out there who's not a performer but just interested in it, just to understand that there are people out there who specialize in this, and that performing artists are elite athletes, even if they're not running great distances, or the way they use their body is the same as an elite athlete, and they need the care and attention that we devote to sports medicine. We're out there as performing arts medicine specialists, but we need to spread the word and let people know that there's help.
Yeah, we may not normally call them athletes, but they really are.
They really are.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Jen. It's been great to have you on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank all of you that have been listening for taking the time to download us and listen. And for those of you that have been regular listeners of the podcast for a while, you know that it is at this time that we have our podcast question of the week. And with that question is our producer, Kelly.
What issue arises when combining dance and vocals?
So there is the podcast question of the week. Be the first person to send us the correct answer to Huffines Podcast at hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those new nifty third edition podcast t-shirts, and they look really cool. Make sure you answer that question. And so for all of us here, we are wrapping up this week. We'd like to thank you again for being with us. And Jenny, once again, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And I hope the rest of you will have a great week. Join us next week for another interesting person in the world of performance medicine. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffbindspodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.